Before we start the podcast today, we need to talk. You know I'm a single mom and I have to support myself and my three children. But what you don't know, because I've never told you, is that I have a master's degree in education and 9 years professional teaching experience. And rather than running BTR, which is a super full-time job, I could be working full-time as a teacher and getting a salary and benefits. But instead, I work full-time as the CEO of Betrayal Trauma Recovery. And the time has come. After building Betrayal Trauma Recovery from scratch and working overtime every day for the last 18 months with no pay, with no salary, with no benefits, it's time for me to be able to support my family as the CEO of Betrayal Trauma Recovery and the producer and the host of the Betrayal Trauma Recovery podcast. It's impossible for me to be the CEO of a full-fledged nonprofit where I work full-time and then also work another full-time job. It's just impossible, especially being a single mom of three children under eight. And I really feel like it's my calling to run BTR because seriously, there are plenty of English teachers in the world, but not very many betrayal trauma recovery podcasters. And that's where you come in. I need you to donate to Betrayal Trauma Recovery so that I can continue to bring you free, quality information and education on this podcast. I know many of you are struggling financially in the worst way, and I understand that. For those of you who can afford $5 a month or $10 a month to support this podcast and all the technical costs, which are really expensive, and all the hours of behind-the-scenes work that I do to help women all over the world come out of isolation and get to safety, your donation will support this important work. I'm grateful that I have my teaching career to fall back on, but I really feel like Betrayal Trauma Recovery is my true calling and my life's work, and it's my sincere desire to be able to support my family while doing my life's work. So please go to btr.org and donate. Click the donate button and choose monthly. Set it and forget it, and your monthly donation will enable me to continue to run Betrayal Trauma Recovery and support my family. For those of you who have donated in the past and for all of our amazing clients who help make BTR possible, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support. For those of you who are unable to donate monthly, we do have a goal on Giving Tuesday, which is next Tuesday, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, to raise $5,000. This can cover many of the costs that we have associated with betrayal trauma recovery, especially the website costs and the technical costs. I'm really going for that goal and would really appreciate your help making that goal. There's a little bar on our website to see where we are. Let's make that happen. And for those of you who can set a monthly donation, maybe make the first donation on Giving Tuesday and then set the monthly donation for the rest of the year. So let's see if we can reach that Giving Tuesday goal. On another note, our Betrayal Trauma Recovery Club is open and available throughout the holiday season. The coaches are experts at boundaries and grief, therapeutic disclosures and polygraphs, self-worth, protecting your children, managing triggers, surviving divorce and thriving, relapse preparedness, etc. In the Betrayal Trauma Recovery Club, you can go to the coaches with whatever you need, and we'll be adding more sessions on December 1st, so keep an eye out for that. And now, this week's podcast. Welcome to Betrayal Trauma Recovery. This is Anne. Today I have Forrest Benedict. He is a husband and father who lives in Fresno, California, and he's also the first man I've ever had on the podcast, which is very exciting. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a certified sexual addiction treatment provider. Forrest is the clinical director of an outpatient sexual addiction treatment program in Central Valley, California. He's also the program manager of the Sexual Addiction Treatment Provider Program at Mid-America Nazarene University. He is the author of the highly acclaimed book, Life After Lust, Stories and Strategies for Sex and Pornography Addiction Recovery. His book is based on his personal recovery journey, experience, and research. Welcome, Forrest.
Thank you, Anne. I'm really grateful to be here.
So, Forrest, tell us about your personal recovery experience and the work you do now with sex addicts and their partners.
So really what brought me to do this work, like many people that get into this field, I was raised in a pretty difficult upbringing with an alcoholic father and had some difficult traumas. Even though I was raised to be religious, I did find pornography at a pretty young age and became addicted to pornography, and really led this double life throughout my teen years. You know, it wasn't until I was about 24 years old when I decided I really needed to take my recovery seriously. Thankfully, it was before I was married, got into treatment. I really did take full responsibility for my recovery and just felt led to do this work. So I went and got my master's degree and got to start working in a program treating sex addicts and help others is part of this path that I feel like is a result of the recovery that I've done.
Forrest, in your experience, why is it essential for partners to look for visible changes in their addict husband's life instead of simply trusting the verbal promises of change that addicts often profess? They say, oh, I'm changing. My own ex said things like, I have a plan, you know, yeah. Like when I said, okay, you need a plan. And he was like, oh, I have a plan. Yeah. But I literally never saw a plan, you know?
Yeah.
So why is it so essential for the partners to look for those visible changes to their behavior?
Well, I think it's really essential because so many partners in this situation have been lied to for so many years. There's been so much secrecy. Once the addiction is discovered, the addict usually really believes that they're going to change and really wants to change. But I'll tell people, even in the intake, that words mean nothing at this point. You've already proven that words mean nothing based on how you've used words in the past and created a really unhealthy and unsafe situation as a result of how you've used those words. And so action is everything. It's not just action, because a lot of partners I work with, they've seen some action in the past, but it was a performance. It wasn't even real. So I think it's more than just action. It's also an attitude change. The biggest attitude change is humility, that they're willing to humble themselves and submit to the process and willing to acknowledge the trauma that they've caused and get out of a victim mentality where they act like they can't do anything. And there's different attitude changes, learning to be patient with their partner. I talk about how the addict gets this burden off of themselves and they feel this huge relief, but then the partner is carrying that burden from then on. So they need to be patient with that process. That would be another attitude change that would be something that the partner could see happening. Unless there's visible signs, there's no foundation. There's nothing to know that there's any change happening.
If you say, hey, you need an attitude change, right? And then the person says, well, my attitude has changed.
Yeah, exactly.
Why are you telling me my attitude hasn't changed when it has changed? Like, clearly it has.
Exactly.
Not.
Yeah. The defensiveness, the pride, you know, needing to be right and not willing to listen. Those are not good.
In my ex's case, he ended up writing my therapist and she wouldn't share it with me because she said it was so abusive. But she said the gist of it is he admits to being abusive. He says, I was abusive, but
oh gosh,
let me list the 60 things or the 24 things or whatever it was that she did.
Yeah.
Right. And my therapist said, this is so abusive that I will not read it to you. Like,
wow.
you cannot see
it. Wow.
She said, so this clearly shows that he is not taking responsibility and he is not in a place to do that. And I thought, that's really interesting. You know, if you start with, I'm really sorry that I was abusive, but let me tell you all the things that you're doing wrong. Clearly, they're not in that humble, willing to submit place, right?
Yeah. My wife tells me this, that if I apologize and put the word but after it, that it nullifies it. I've learned not to do that because it doesn't work.
So what are some of the signs of an addict that may not be in recovery?
The prideful attitude, the defensiveness. Also, a lot of addicts initially think that if they're just sober, that they are recovering. A lot of addicts need to learn how to take care of themselves, manage stress, manage their emotions. If they're going to therapy, if they're actually learning and practicing those tools, I really believe addicts need structure. All of the addicts that I work with, I'm assigning them things that they have to do on a daily basis, you know, to connect with themselves, connect with their higher power, connect with their partner. Recovery is learning to actually take care of themselves in a healthy way. And I think a partner would definitely notice if they were starting to do that, or at least trying to do that and trying to move forward. If they can start to see that the addict in their life is really trying to change some of these ways they relate to themselves, they relate to others. Again, that humble attitude makes a big difference. And they're not going to be perfect at it, but it's definitely not an excuse to relapse or to go back into this passivity that I think led most of them to that situation. So it's hard work, especially when a lot of the addicts that I've worked with came from emotionally neglectful or abusive situations themselves. And so a lot of this is very difficult work for them. I always said that this was the hardest thing I've ever done. If they're willing to do it and keep at it and get an accountability partner and go to groups and do whatever they need to do, then it's obvious they're investing in a lifestyle change and making themselves safer to be in a relationship with.
At Betrayal Trauma Recovery, our number one goal is to help women establish safety from the addiction and then the related behaviors, lying, infidelity, the porn use, but also the gaslighting, the emotional abuse, and some of the narcissistic behaviors that tend to come out in an active addict or someone who might be white knuckling it but not be in recovery. Some of the signs that I saw in my own situation, I set a no contact boundary after my husband's arrest for domestic violence, waiting for him to show some signs of recovery. And instead, I saw things like he shut down my bank account, for example, or he would text me and berate me about the clothes that he wanted me to pack for the kids when he would see the kids, but they weren't there, or diapers. And I was like, okay, you can go to the store and get diapers. Like, there are so many things that you can take responsibility for and show, like, I am stepping up to the plate here, that he did not do. So those actions are the things that are important. But part of the thing that was so difficult during that time was that I was hearing from other people that he was saying things like, I want to do this. I want my marriage to work, but I can't do anything because she won't talk to me. And he would play the victim. So it was just so frustrating because I thought, like, someone needs to tell him what to do, right? Because he can't figure it out. And he still didn't figure it out. His solution was to file for divorce. But I think that knowing what the signs are of emotional abuse, that's why we have our books section of our website. And I really recommend that women read all of the books on our website so that they can have an understanding, even if they don't suspect that porn is happening anymore, even if they don't suspect that infidelity is continuing, that they know what to look for to be aware of the emotional abusive behaviors. Because from the wife's perspective and from Betrayal Trauma Recovery's perspective, we do not believe that the reasons matter. Like, it could be a personality disorder. It could be his addiction. It could be trauma. It could be a myriad of different causes for why these behaviors keep happening. But to the wife, it doesn't matter. The more she tries to focus on what is the cause of these behaviors, the more she's sucked into that vortex of abuse rather than taking a step out and saying, he is the one that's responsible for figuring himself out. And in the meantime, I need to stand at a safe distance and set some boundaries so that I'm not continually abused through this process.
Yeah. And I would definitely agree with that. Anytime I mention that the addicts have a difficult challenge ahead of them because of their upbringing or their background, it's never to make an excuse for them or say, you know, well, I guess it's okay that he's being passive. I agree. And that sounds like a very healthy way to look at it, because obviously the partner can't recover for him and there's no help in trying to figure out why. Partners ask why all the time and there's never a satisfying answer to that.
So you've led a partner group for years now. Tell me how that work inspired the piece in your book called What My Wife Is Worth.
I found that when we started to work on boundaries with the partners in my group, that they had a really hard time creating boundaries, but also enforcing them. And as I helped work through what's stopping them from doing this, I felt like a lot of them had difficulties seeing their own worth, feeling like I deserve to be treated well. I deserve to be in a relationship with somebody that's healthy or working towards that. I really felt like it was related to that, their self-esteem or their own worth. And then Jennifer Lamprey was doing an event for women called The Quickening. She asked me to write a piece from a male's perspective. She thought that it'd be really powerful to have a male speak to women. It was interesting. You know, this piece, I just sat down and wrote this piece in like an hour. It was inspired, really. It came to me. A lot of the stuff I write takes hours and hours, and I'm like trying to make it perfect and whatever, but this just came to me, and I feel like it was one of the most validating pieces that I've ever written from my perspective as an addict in recovery. That I wrote it as an addict in recovery saying what my wife is worth, that she's worth my best recovery efforts. You know, I went into detail about what that looks like, you know, that it's not about how much sex I get or what mood she's in, that I need to be working hard at my own growth, my own healing. I feel like it really communicated well to the partners that they deserve that, to be in that type of relationship, so they can set boundaries that do protect that worth and do communicate to the addict that they do deserve to be treated with respect and to be cherished. That was how that came about, and I found that to be really helpful.
We'll link to that article on our website. If you go to btr.org/podcast, you can find our interview with Forrest there, and the link will be in that section. If you have comments about this episode, comment. Let us know what you're thinking, any questions that you have or concerns. We love it when you interact with us. Forrest, how does that article, What My Life Is Worth, and then the partner version, which is written from the wife's perspective, called What I Am Worth, help wives understand the addict behaviors that make up good recovery?
It says, my wife is a woman of infinite worth. Because of this, she deserves my best efforts. She deserves a husband who only has eyes for her. She deserves a husband in active recovery, not passively going with the flow. She deserves a husband who reminds her that she is not to blame for his past or present choices. She deserves a husband who actively opposes visual and mental lust in all forms, viewing it as the enemy of true intimacy. So it just kind of goes on like that, about being trustworthy, about not blaming her. It really sets up this ideal, but I don't think it's too unrealistic. It's really things that are like, yeah, I do want to be treated that way. I do deserve to be the only woman for the addicts. My intention is to call them up to a higher level of intentionality and commitment with their recovery. I find that when they read it, it often does trigger shame, but I hope that they would turn that into a healthy guilt that would be like, oh yeah, I can live up to this. I don't want to live that way, which was the opposite of this in the past. I actually love writing to inspire people, and I feel like setting the standard and saying, let's strive for this, is really helpful. I just don't want to sit in this kind of mediocre place, because it doesn't help anyone achieve recovery.
One of the things that happened to me because of my ex's extreme case, I guess, is that he went to therapy for years. He read things like this. Well, I made him read things like this. I put it in front of him. I took him to conferences, et cetera, et cetera. And he really learned how to talk the language of recovery without actually doing the recovery work. So I think just the focus of this episode on watching for those actions. So he may say, I only have eyes for you, you know, whatever he's going to say. And then how is he really actually treating you? You know, does he listen? Is he patient? If you ask a question, does he answer it without getting defensive? Is he willing to listen to your opinion? Is he willing to be, in John Gottman's words, influenced, right? Is he willing to be influenced by his wife, or is he just kind of like, why does she keep bothering me? You know, when will the behaviors speak for themselves? I think is one thing that wives need to always be looking for.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I love the idea of her catching him doing the right thing. But it's not like him doing the right thing in front of her intentionally to perform or to pretend. But yeah, that she would be surprised when she walks out and he's working on his recovery materials, or when he says, hey, I can't do this tonight because I'm really tired and I'm going to be triggered tomorrow if I don't get this sleep. Catching glimpses of that, oh, he's really changing his view on this. I know this is so difficult because of the unsafety of the past when it's all been a performance, but it all looked like it was the right actions. I'm always emphasizing that addicts need to be seeing people that specialize in this and have certification, because they may be even put on performance for the therapist. The therapist needs to know if that's happening.
Know how to address that. Absolutely. So I want to talk about your book, Life After Lust. Why do you think it's important for wives to read and not just addicts?
Yeah, well, I actually didn't really think about the possibility that partners would read the book. I did write it for the addicts, but one of the people that had endorsed the book does partner work, and she ended up doing a blog post later about how this book is fitting for lots of different audiences, but also partners, and she's a partner herself. It kind of fits with what I said about what my wife is worth. It gives partners hope that a recovery journey is possible. I think there's so much uncertainty in the beginning when everything comes to light, and maybe they seek initial help, or maybe they haven't even sought help yet. But I think it can feel very hopeless. Also, I put a lot of my own story into this book. It's not just like saying, hey, people can recover, but I'm sharing some of my own journey and what some of that can look like. And I definitely don't present it like I'm perfect and everyone should follow me, you know. But I also talk about some vulnerable times in my recovery and how I responded to those. And some of that could make a partner a little bit nervous if they're like, oh, he was struggling with lust and then he got back on track, you know. But I've also been free from acting out with pornography for over 13 years. And so I really feel like that is possible. Just showing people that that's possible is hopeful. And the other thing about it too, for your audience to know, is that I am very sensitive and aware of the partner's experience. I know when this lady read my book from a partner's experience herself, she was worried that she would be triggered. And she found herself just really relieved and really encouraged. I wrote the book in such a way that honors partners. I've recommended books to partners in my groups that they just were so triggered. And, you know, maybe it went into tons of detail about acting out experiences and it just triggered all their trauma. I would say in that sense, this book is safe for a partner to read and can also be very hopeful.
You know, it's very interesting from my perspective because I speak with women all over the world about their experience with their addict spouse. And I have two feelings about it that are not mutually exclusive, but they may seem like they are. And it is, number one, that I absolutely know that people can change. If they make the decision to change and they work at it, in my own faith feeling, they involve God in the process and they genuinely are humble, accountable, and honest and willing to submit to God's will, that anything can happen. And even myself right now, I am in the process of changing, right? In asking God to help me with certain character defects that I have and things that I'm dealing with in my everyday life that I really want to improve. And I'm not completely healed yet or changed yet, but I have faith that as I continue to do that, I can change. And I believe that about everybody. So that being said, just because people can change does not mean they will. Sitting back and observing, are they really genuine about this? And what are they doing to show that? Is what betrayal trauma recovery is all about. How do we establish safe boundaries while we observe from a distance to see is this change real? Is this change deep and lasting? And is it sincere? Rather than, is this just another way of keeping me in this abuse cycle?
Yeah, I think that's a really healthy way to look at this. I use a lot of language about partners keeping themselves safe, and is the addict acting in such a way that makes it safe for them? And so I definitely wouldn't recommend even trusting. I know partners often never fully trust, even if the addict's doing great recovery, but it's unsafe to trust unless there is real evidence of change.
Well, I really appreciate your work, Forrest, and your writing is incredible.
It's
all over the internet and copious amounts of writing. Awesome. I'm a writer too, so I really appreciate that about you. And I think that's really great work that you're doing, helping educate other people about what it takes to recover. Because that's not our focus here at Betrayal Trauma Recovery. We don't worry so much about how the addict's going to recover or what he's going to do specifically. Our focus is more, come what may, whatever he decides to do, we will stay safe until we see these particular characteristics that we need in order to have a healthy relationship. So I really appreciate those working with the addicts who have that expertise who can help them, because as a wife who has been injured by that, we're just not able to do that.
Yeah, that can definitely get very unhealthy when you feel like you are responsible for making sure they're doing all the right things or making sure you need to catch them if they do the wrong things. It's so important for the addict to have their own accountability and their own therapist, and you know, whatever they need, you guys are doing some great work as far as helping partners work on their own healing and maintain a safe distance. So that's great to see.
You can find links to Forrest's website and Forrest's work on our site, btr.org. And thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Being here
I'm
today,
grateful
Forrest.
To be here. Appreciate it.
If this podcast is helpful to you, please rate it on iTunes. Every single rating increases our visibility in search engines and helps women who are isolated find us. If you are interested in getting one-on-one help with one of our certified APSATS coaches, please go to btr.org where you can see all of our coaches' bios. You can schedule a support call or join a support group. And until next week, stay safe out there.